People say that I threw my brain away, that I'm illogical and don't have much to say. Some people say that it's foolish to believe in what we cannot say, from what is saved. Well, thank you again for joining me here on this episode of the Freed Thinker podcast. As always, I'm your host, Tyler Vella. And on this episode of the podcast and YouTube Live, I'm going to be going over one of a really common objections that we Christians get from our skeptical friends and neighbors and family members, that we just pick and choose and cherry pick the Bible for verses that we like and don't like, and which laws we want to obey and don't obey, so on and so forth. So if you appreciate this content or any other content, please consider becoming a sponsor. You can either sponsor us on Patreon or follow the Become a Sponsor link on the blog. If you can't afford to sponsor, or you just don't want to, but you like the show, please head on over to iTunes and give us a rating and a review. It really helps us show up higher in search results and helps spread the show around. It really does matter. Share the love. So with that, on to this episode dealing with cherry picking from the Bible. Enjoy the show. I'd like to give some basic thoughts on how I'd respond to an oft-posed atheistic objection. Do I eat shellfish? Absolutely. With tons of butter, actually. Do I wear clothes of mixed cloth? You can't see what pants I'm wearing, but I am right now. Don't I think that the Ten Commandments are morally prescriptive to the church? Yes, I do. Well then, according to the atheist, I must be cherry-picking from the Bible for verses that I want to believe and the ones I don't, especially those from the Old Testament Mosaic Law. This is another very common mistake that many online atheists make. Ironically, this was not a big complaint from atheists in generations past because they were familiar with the Christian theology of the New Covenant. Basic theology and hermeneutics was commonly part of primary education, but those days are gone. However, many modern atheists just do not take the time to actually familiarize themselves with Christian theology and the history of interpretation. But can we really blame them? I mean, most modern Christians I know don't really know either. I don't think most Christians I know could really answer this challenge, if I'm being honest. We have a generation of biblically illiterate Christians, so why should it surprise us that we have biblically illiterate atheists? So, what is the misunderstanding that this objection is based on? It's such a short objection, but I'm sorry, it's going to be a little bit longer of an answer. Well, the reason why Christians don't adhere to these kinds of laws from the Old Covenant has literally nothing to do with some kind of textual cherry-picking or wanting to observe some laws and not others. There are, in fact, many different theological ways to answer this question, but I'm going to give the answer which has been a long-standing theological distinction made based on the New Testament and covenant theology, that is, from within a Reformed perspective. If you're an atheist listening to this, you don't have to believe that the Bible's true in order to follow my line of reasoning here. But you can at least attempt to understand what I mean and what it says in the text to accurately and reasonably engage with Christians. I don't need to agree with philosophical naturalism in order to accurately understand it and pose objections based on that understanding. That's just what it is to avoid a straw man. So those skeptics who pose the cherry-picking objection against me are really just grasping at straw. So here I am to help you better understand my position and the position of many Christians throughout millennia. The first thing to remember is something that's almost so obvious that it shouldn't need to be stated, but I'm going to anyways. And that is that Christians don't just have the Old Testament. We also have the New Testament, and we read the entire catalog of scriptural books, it's really an anthology, as being a contiguous whole, as diverse as it may be. anyone who's read the books of Romans, Galatians, Ephesians, and Hebrews, for example, will know immediately that the answer to why we do not follow the Old Testament Levitical law in detail is not because we like shellfish but still want to condemn rape, but rather for biblical theological reasons. I'll try to keep this as brief as I can, but sorry, such atheists are basically asking a question that involves a relationship between the Mosaic covenant with the nation of Israel and the new covenant with the redeemed people of God, which is not the geopolitical nation of Israel. I'm going to do this in simple list format to make it more, as brief as possible and easy to respond to specific points if you choose to. Also, this is where a fully developed concept of the distinction between law and gospel would be super beneficial. Now, while I'm here going to do more of an apologetical, hermeneutical technique type of response, I highly recommend that for those interested in deeper theology and diving into this type of response, I recommend looking up the law-gospel distinction in Reformed theology. So, to start, I'm also going to answer some of the questions about specific laws in their historical and cultural context, or at least categories of laws, and provide some of the principles that possibly underpinned why these laws were given, as well as some of the important things to help us move from the historical context of the law to our modern context and which principles carry through. After that, we're going to look at some of the reasons to move into more theological and hermeneutical principles and helping us understand how we read, interpret, and apply the law to the church. Okay, number one, what's with the weird laws? I mean, one of the strange things that has worked out in the kind of Jewish-Christian divide is that Leviticus and Deuteronomy are some of the first books that Jewish children learn, while they're the books that many even mature Christians aren't familiar with at all. Many of a New Year's resolution to read the entire Bible end right where Leviticus begins, which is a shame. This was, in many respects, the worship manual for the people of God under Moses. It answered the question, how do God's people come into the presence of a holy God? But let's be honest, some of the laws are just so strange. Why could they only eat some fish, but not eels or shellfish? Why could they eat cows and rabbits, but not pigs? So let's look into some of that. So there are different reasons given for why some of these regulations exist, which sometimes just seem completely arbitrary. And there's some different schools of thought on that. The first one is that some of the laws were given for hygiene purposes. That is to keep the Israelites healthy while they were wandering in the wilderness. This is the view of commentators like Harrison and Harris, who argue for something like this. They would say the unclean animals like the pig carry more diseases. That discharge in Leviticus 12 and 15 were more likely to be infectious. So they're kind of sanitation laws. This may go into some of the laws, but it clearly doesn't explain a huge bulk of them. So it can't be a total rationale. And if this was the purpose, why would Jesus later declare them to be clean, even though sanitation standards and everything really hadn't changed that much by the time of his life? Okay, that's the first view. Not that convincing. It might explain one or two of the laws, but probably not so much. The other views really fall under what could be called a symbolic interpretation. And by symbolic interpretation, we don't mean that don't eat pigs was some, you know, mystical symbolic thing, but rather the reason behind why they were given wasn't so much that pigs were unclean, but that something about them represented something else, and that's why pigs were chosen. So it's not that the law was symbolic, but that there was some type of symbolism that was driving to a deeper meaning. The first view of this symbolic interpretation is a strict allegorical view. This was the view that old Jewish commentators like Philo took, and it was that that there was some behavior or habit of the clean animals that are kind of living illustrations of how the righteous Israelites ought to behave, while the unclean animals represented maybe sinful habits of how men would behave. So for a good example is the animals that are clean are those that chew the cud. And chewing the cud, where they're really eating their food, swallowing it down, digesting a little bit, and bringing the cud back up and re-chewing it to kind of re-digest it as they go, represented meditating on the law of God. You would chew on it, swallow it, you'd stop thinking about it for a while, but then you'd bring it back up and think about it again and chew on it some more and meditate on it more. So that was kind of the strict allegorical view of commentators like Philo. You have other views like that of Mary Douglas. She was an anthropologist who tried to explain some of the practices of the surrounding societies, and she came up with kind of an anthropological approach. And this was that some of the food laws were a way to keep order or to classify locomotion and the within the creation order, and that somehow this represented some human trait. Similar to the allegorical approach, but it's a little bit more of a one-to-one parallel between the animal and the human. So she does an interesting study on the way that different kinds of clean animals moved compared to unclean animals. But to be honest, not many people have really found it that convincing. She also said that that phrase about that the Jews should not eat blood, that the animals in Leviticus 11, 2 through 8 are clean if they chew the cud and they have split hooves. That is basically if they're herbivores and if they're not meat eating, and so they don't eat blood, right? So they're clean because they don't eat blood. And whereas the animals listed in Leviticus 11, 27 are the victims of predators or are predators, and so they're unclean, right? So they either kill or they are dead as the result of killing of others, of other animals. And so they represented this bad trait within humanity. There was also this idea of having no blemishes. The priests weren't allowed to have blemishes and serve as a priest, and so the sacrificial animal wasn't allowed to have a blemish. Unclean animals and the water seemed to lack something that the Israelites may have thought that they needed. So if the fish, you know, a carp or something was a stereotypical fish with its skins and its fins, then other animals that didn't have those features were considered blemish. They were missing something. They were imperfect in some way. There was this type of application that blemish could somehow refer to injustice, and we see some hints at that in Leviticus 24, 19 to 20. So it still kind of falls into the symbolic allegorical, but it kind of has this anthropomorphic thing where the predator was actually maybe more of a stand-in for the human who was predatory on humans, or the victims of predators were stand-in for the victims, and the Jews shouldn't prey on them either, type of one-to-one correlation. So the predators prey on others and they cause injustice. The victims of predators were already victimized. The Jews shouldn't chew on them either, so on and so forth. A lot of this it has largely been unconvincing to most commentators, just because it seems really contrived and there isn't really kind of a unifying idea that goes underneath a lot of these dietary laws. Then we get to a little bit more robust views that did unite more of these laws together. And that was to keep people from idolatry by avoiding pagan sacrificial rites. We're going to cover this later, so I'm going to skip over the detail of this one. But remember this one, because this is one that I largely favor, that the practices were to keep the Israelites to avoid idolatry and some of the pagan sacrificial rites. We'll come back to that one in a little bit more of a relevant time period. We're also told almost explicitly in Leviticus 11, 44 to 47, that the Israelites were to make these distinctions between the clean and the unclean, between the profane and the sacred. And so God tells us what one of his main reasons for having some of these laws was. And it's that Israel was to remain separate from the nations and to consider God and how to be holy in everything that they did, right? So one couldn't prepare a meal without thinking about holiness, without thinking about the righteousness of God, without thinking about how the Jews were to be a separate people called out to be sanctified by God. They were to think about holiness every part of their daily life. No matter what they were doing, no matter what station they had, no matter what their socioeconomic class, they were to think about it when they were cooking, when they were dressing, when they were grooming, when they were with their family, so on and so forth. And so it was something that was a constant reminder to them to think about holiness. right? The food regulations are a good example that set Israel apart as a nation from the other nations, right? It made the other nations see the sanctification or the set apartness of Israel. Israel couldn't eat with any other nations. They literally had to keep themselves separate, right? How could you intermarry with a Canaanite if you can't eat with them, right? It was to give them protection. It was also to protect the seed. You have to remember that the land promises given to Israel, the division of this plot goes to this tribe, this plot goes to this tribe, this plot goes to this tribe, was a system of inheritance. And what happens when you have, this comes up, by the way, in the book of Esther. What happens when you have an Israelite marry a Moabite, right? And then the Israelite dies. Right, you now have a Moabite woman and Moabite children that are in possession and in the inheritance of Israelite land. And so through that, you could actually almost by disinheritance lose the land by a kind of cultural appropriation. That's probably not the right way to say it, but you could actually disinherit the Israelites from the land that God has promised them if they don't follow these protections. If they were obedient to God, God would bless them so that the Gentile world would long to worship Israel's God. And we see this. We see this in the Queen of Sheba who comes to Solomon. We see this in passages like Zechariah 8, 20 to 23. Right? There's a distinction here between the church in the Old Testament and the church in the New Testament, between Israel and the church. And that is that Israel was to be a light that would draw the nations in, whereas the mission of the church is to be a light that radiates and goes out to the nations. So there's a shift that happens, and we see that in the food regulations when we hit the New Testament. Right? Food regulations produce social barriers between the Jews and the Gentiles. So by the time of we reach the New Testament, the regulations had actually been expanded and approved upon, so to speak, by the Pharisees. Right? So what happened when a Jew went out into the market and they came home? Well, they thought they have to wash themselves now. They're now unclean. They've now rubbed shoulders with the Gentiles. They've been on Gentile land. This is why the Jews, when they're going from the north of Israel to Jerusalem in the south, and Samaria was in the middle, they would actually take the long route around because they thought that if they walk through Samaria, they would be bringing unclean Gentile dust from the ground and defiling the land of Israel, right? They'd be bringing that defilement into the land. And so you have these strong barriers of clean and unclean that separated the Gentiles from the Jews as people, right? So what had happened is the uncleanliness laws had actually transformed over time in such an unhealthy way that the Gentiles as a people were now seen as unclean and untouchable. Right? Whereas before, you know, those with leprosy were untouchable. They could be purified through certain rites, and they were allowed to worship. The Gentiles were seen almost as the epitome of uncleanliness. So they actually had to go through a long ceremonial process and effectively become Jews to be seen as clean. Right? So there's this change that happens in the Christian church when Christ comes. Christ comes and he sends his disciples out in the world to go and preach the gospel. Right, so there's a problem now for the early church. How can you go and present the gospel to people whom you can't associate with, you can't eat with, you can't rub shoulders with, you can't go into their houses, right? You can't do all these things. How do you get around it? Right, and that's when you start having some theological development. You start having examples of Mark 7:9, where Jesus talks about it's not what goes into the person that makes them unclean, right? It's what comes out of them, right? It's the unrighteousness that comes out. God reveals in Acts 10 in a vision to Peter that Peter can eat whatever he wants, basically. He shows this whole blanket, this whole picnic, this whole cornucopia of food, and God says, take and eat it. Peter, you know, pretty brazen to talk back to God three times, says, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm a good observant Jew. I'm not going to do it. That'll make me unclean. Three times he says it. God says, take and eat. And finally, Peter gets the message, takes and eats, realizes that this is not just talking about dietary laws, but is talking about the cleanliness and the uncleanness of Gentiles. The Gentiles, they were now to go out to the Gentile nations, and it corrected some of that hard wall between them. We see this problem arise in Galatians 2, where Paul sees these cleanliness, uncleanliness, the division between the Jews and the Gentiles that has gospel implications. The Christians are no longer to be physically separate from the Gentiles, from the pagans. We're to eat with them. We're to fellowship, different type of fellowship. Eat with them, you know, go into their houses, be among them, walk with them, work with them. We're to be entirely among them. We're to be in the world, but there's still a general equity of the law, and we're going to talk about what that means here in a little bit. There's still a general principle under the law that we're not to be of the world. We're now to go out in it. There's some rollback on how the Pharisees had developed some of that, some of the regulations about uncleanliness. There's some of that has been rolled back, but there's general equity in the law about the clean and the unclean, about keeping yourself pure. But it now in the Christian church, that general equity has much more of a moral, ethical, righteousness sense, and far less so of a ceremonial sense. So that's a little bit of the background of some of the textual development. Another thing we should remember is that there's a difference between unclean and unholy. That is, between being ceremonially unclean and being unclean in kind of that symbolic sense of unrighteousness. But this is a really common mistake that readers of the Bible often make, whether they're Christians or atheists or Jews or otherwise. When we read many of the laws about the uncleanliness and the impurity in the Mosaic law, we should not think that it meant that those people were somehow sinning in some way, that sex with your spouse or touching the dead body of a dead relative in preparation for their burial, for example, somehow made them sinful. Right? Those aren't immoral actions, but under the Mosaic law, it did render that person ceremonially unclean. They would not be able to, they would need to be able to complete some kind of ritual of purification before they could re-enter the community in worship of Yahweh at the tabernacle. This was especially the case for the priests and the Levites who ministered before the Lord there. So, the unrighteousness or the sin would come in if one became unclean without concern or care to becoming unclean or to becoming clean and returning to worship, or one who returns to worship without having been purified and making the tabernacle or the other worshipers there themselves unclean, right? They would be sinning with what the Bible called a high hand. Right, that's the Hebrew equivalent of kind of flipping the bird to Yahweh and his holiness, right? They're saying, I don't care about your regulations. I know I'm unclean, but I'm going to do what I want to anyways. Right? That's where the sin would come in. It's more of a disobedience. But we shouldn't think that purity laws just were holiness laws in kind of that moral sense. By the way, as an aside, besides simply making the distinction between cleanliness and righteousness or uncleanliness and sin, one historically relevant fact I think is helpful in understanding these laws. The pagan nations surrounding Israel engaged in all manner of lewd cultic practices, including things like cultic prostitution of men, women, and children, bestiality, sex with corpses, child sacrifice. They would engage in ancestor worship of the dead and all these other types of things. Fertility especially played a prominent role in the Canaanite worship of Baal and his consort Ashtoreth, and would involve orgies and prostitution and so forth. I mean, one of the common motifs in the Bible, specifically in the first five books of Moses, also called the Pentateuch, in which these laws that we're talking about are found, is that of polemics. That is, the author would directly or indirectly satirize or theologically insult the views of the surrounding religious systems. For those of you who've listened to or read my work on Genesis 1, you know that I think polemics plays a huge role in the early chapters of Genesis. So too with the law. I think we see some strong conceptual polemics against the Canaanite cultic worship practices. Think about the kinds of grotesque worship practices that the Israelites literally could not partake in within sacred space set apart for Yahweh. Remember, to be unclean meant that Yahweh said you ought not be near or in the tabernacle or the temple, right? Especially if you're a priest. So if you're touching a dead body makes you ceremonially unclean, they could not engage in any kind of child or human sacrifice in service of Yahweh. They also couldn't bring in the remains of dead ancestors and engage in ancestor worship, which was a very, very common thing in the pagan religions that surrounded them. Also, if sex makes one unclean, right? Remember, it made you unclean for a day. You had to purify, and you were unclean for a day. They couldn't engage in orgies or temple prostitution in service of Yahweh, right? Not only did God expressly condemn most of the practices, right? He obviously didn't condemn sex with your spouse, but he condemned a bunch of these other ones, prostitutions, orgies, human sacrifice, child sacrifice, ancestor worship, right? All these kinds of things, right? Not only did he condemn those practices, but he also set up the tabernacle and the temple and the cultic life of Israel such that they were to fiercely protect the cleanliness of sacred space, that to engage in any of those cultic practices would be categorically opposed to that, right? Not only are those practices immoral, but the Jews could not give religious reasons to justify them, right? We shouldn't think that the Canaanites were just running around all day, every day, sleeping with prostitutes and killing their children, right? They knew that doing that was evil in everyday life. But what they did was they came up with religious reasons to do it, right? Baal and his consort Ashtaroth needed to copulate for there to be rain. Yeah, by the way, Baal's ejaculate was what they thought rain was. Sorry, that's just something that can't be unimagined. So sorry for putting that in your mind. And so they wanted to help them get it on by putting on orgies and sex shows and prostitutes and engaging with prostitutes for them, right? Now, you may want to chalk that up to horny and perverse priests. And sure, that was likely part of it. That may have been the motivation for how this came about. But notice that excuse was not supposed to be possible in Israel. God was telling them, you can't do that in your house, but you can't do it in my house either. Right? So God set up some of these laws as a protection for Israel against some of these ungodly worship practices. Number three, Christians have, since the earliest writers, I mean, we see it in the first, in the four New Testament books that I listed above, as well as other places like Acts 15, they've seen a distinction between three different kinds of Old Testament laws. These are the civil magisterial laws regulating the governance of geopolitical Israel on issues such as her taxation, penal code, kingship, building codes, etc. There's also the ceremonial or priestly laws, which regulated the cultic religious life of the faithful Jew and covered issues of sacrifice, clean and unclean, holiness codes, structures of worship, etc. And finally, there was the moral ethical laws about private morality of the godly person and is best summarized in the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments. And by the way, there can be some laws that kind of dip their toes in two or more of these categories. Now, it's generally recognized, even by atheists, that the effect of Jesus's coming had on the ceremonial law was to abrogate it, right? Or to complete it, to fulfill the promises of it and to make those laws no longer needed, right? Typically, our atheist interlocutors will not challenge us on why we're not sacrificing bulls and goats and sheep any longer, right? The sacrifice of Jesus as the fulfillment of the religious signs and symbols and purpose of the ceremonial life of Israel is really hardly under dispute, even among critics. The objection almost always comes around what falls under civil law. Or if they do bring up the ceremonial law, they're not talking really about the cultic practices, but they're dealing more with some of the ceremonial mundane practices, the shaving of your sideburns, the wearing mixed fabrics, which all fell under the symbolism of the cultic life of the faithful Jew. So it's helpful to remember that the ceremonial laws, all of them, pointed us towards Christ and our life in him, and expired with the death, burial and resurrection of Jesus, right? But what about the civil laws, right? Why don't we stone people anymore? Why don't we leave the corners of our fields unharvested? Well, the Westminster Confession of Faith, which is a reformed confession, in chapter 19, section 4, makes this comment about the law, speaking of Israel specifically. Quote, "To them also, as a body politic, he gave sundry judicial laws, which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any other now, further than the general equity thereof may require," end quote. Basically, those civil laws ended with it when Israel ended, and no one's obligated to keep the laws of Israel except beyond where the general equity might require them, right? Basically, hey, if you're not part of the Commonwealth of Israel, if you're not a citizen of that nation, you're not obliged to follow that law, except in the sense that there's this general equity of some of the moral principles of those law that transcend those laws, right? This is important for our discussion here because it was readily recognized that the law which was given at Sinai under Moses to the Jews as they were being formed into the nation of Israel, the Commonwealth or the body politic, that this law expired when the state ceased to be. The civil law with its penalties was for the theocratic nation state of Israel. And as such, these laws just are not binding on Christians. Mostly, right? Remember that little clause in there, further than the general equity thereof may require, which again means that the law itself may have expired, but there's typically is this general equity, this underlying moral, ethical principle that we're all still beholden as the people of God to keep. So for example, Deuteronomy 22:8, we find a civil law, right? It reads, quote, "When you build a new house, you shall make a parapet for your roof, so that you will not bring blood guilt on your house if anyone falls from it," end quote. A parapet is kind of just like a ledge around the side, a little fence that keeps people from falling over, right? Now, is the intent of this law that it's morally good in and of itself just to have a parapet, right? To have this small fence around one's roof? Well, no. I mean, in fact, in many modern houses with our sharp angled eaves, the parapet really just becomes pointless. However, what's the general equity? What's the underlying ethical principle? Well, at that time period, the roof of one's house was a point of relaxation. It was kind of where the party went. Many people would sleep out on their roofs. And so the ethic behind this is clearly that we're to be responsible and to make sure that our properties are safe. And that if we do not adequately build or maintain our properties, then we're liable when someone gets hurt on our property due to our neglect. It's basically an early version of building safety codes. So while Christians are not obligated to keep the jot and tittle of the law, so to speak, they do have ethical obligations to the general equity of the law. Okay, next, number 4. It brings up the next concept, which is helpful for us when understanding the Christian's obligation to the imperatives of the law in the Old Testament. One of the gifts of the Reformation was to consider the various ways that the law is incumbent upon the Christian and the church. Effectively, when applying the law and that general equity principle, what is the grid through which we do it? Like the threefold division of the law, there's also a threefold application of the law, commonly called the three uses of the law. The first use is the pedagogical use. This use of the law is to shine a light on our inability to perfectly keep the moral law or the ethical general equity. It shows us our unrighteousness and our need for God as Savior in our lives. The purpose of the pedagogical use of the law is to drive us to the cross, to show us our sin and worthy and how worthy we are of condemnation. It's this use of the law, which is used in instruction and evangelism to kind of hold up a mirror to us and to our sin, and then show us the hope that's held out to us in the gospel. This is the use of the law that Charles Spurgeon was referring to when he said that the law was like the prick of a needle, which needs to first inflict its pain before it can pull through the silken and crimson thread of the gospel to heal our wounds. So that's the first use. The second use is the civil or the magisterial use of the law. This is the use for the law for the magistrate or the governor or the legislator and how they should apply it. So thinking back to the parapet, the legislator may not require laws that houses have parapets, but they will seek to have a reasonable and robust building code geared toward the public good. This can also be used to help the magistrate restrain evil through threat of force. A good example would be the general equity of laws like Exodus 21, 22 to 25, where a forced miscarriage that results in the death of a child is punishable by death, right? This fell under the principle of the lex talionis, a life for a life, and under which the modern politician may seek to legislate punitive and or retributive damages to those who intentionally or even unintentionally act in such a way that leads to the death of a child in the womb. This is a big verse in the case against abortion. The third use of the law is the moral or the normative use. This is like the civil use, but instead of being for the public servant, for the public good, this is for the private Christian. This is often the one that most impacts the question of cherry picking. How should the individual Christian apply the general equity of the law to themselves, to their lives, to their daily situations? This is really the principal use of the law, in which the believer is taking the law and seeking to understand it and how it is to be obeyed in their life and in their context. So when a Christian is seeking to understand the application of the law to their lives, how they should obey it, not only should we ask what kind of law we're dealing with, but we should then seek to understand how it applies to us under the different uses of the law. By the way, I'm also going to stop here and kind of go off script. If you haven't seen my previous episodes dealing with slavery, dealing with the law in Exodus 21 that atheists say is a manual for beating slaves, which it's not. If you didn't see my episode, I think it was one or two episodes before this one, dealing with that law that atheists say, oh, it's evil that you have to force a rapist to, or, you know, force a rape victim to marry her rapist. Again, not what that verse is talking about. It's also really important to read a verse, even if it's a law, in context of the entire law code. We don't read these laws, these casuistic laws, these for instance type of laws, in isolation apart from the rest of the law code. You're just going to distort the meaning of a ton of laws if you do that. Okay, number three, the next concept is that many of these laws are used as something like life illustrations. And we've kind of touched on this already, but I want to develop it. This is a hard concept for modern hearers to grasp because we don't really have laws like this anymore. We discussed this a little bit in the history section above, and I've discussed this in other episodes, but basically these laws were meant to keep and remind the Jews of their need to be holy and not give in to other religions or immoral practices. So when they only wore unmixed clothing, they were to be reminded of their need to not mix their lifestyles with the lifestyles of the Canaanites, for example. So some laws are in place as life illustrations and reminders to the Jews of their history and their standing as a distinct and hopefully holy people. When they went into other lands, for example, in Egypt or in the exile, and they had to be particular about the food or the cloth that they brought that they bought at market, it would be a reminder to them of their identity as God's peculiar and particular people, and possibly even a way to share God and his righteousness with other people, right? This, again, is, you know, where the Queen of Sheba comes to hear Solomon and to bless the nations. Number four, the Bible is structured around ancient Near Eastern legal practices of these contracts called covenants, right? So we have the Adamic covenant with Adam, we have the Noahic covenant with Noah, Abrahamic covenant with Abraham, Mosaic covenant with Moses for Israel, the Davidic covenant for David and for the king of Israel, and then we have the New Covenant. So what's a covenant? Well, it's often the form of a treaty, and the form that a treaty would take between a great king, which we call a suzerain, and a lesser king, which we call a vassal. But it could also be an arrangement or an agreement between two or more people, like in a marriage covenant. Now, in the ancient world, a covenant would be structured in several different ways, but typically they were structured around the following format or some close variation of it. First, there would be a preamble, right? It'd be the initiating party involved says who they are and what they've done and kind of what the backstory is and how they've arrived at this agreement. Next, there'd be the stipulations. That's what the agreement is. What are the obligations of each one of the parties involved? Then there'd be the blessings and the consequences for keeping and or breaking the covenant. So you'd have blessings for keeping it, and then you have curses or some type of bad outcome for violating or breaking the covenant. Now, covenants can also be either conditional or unconditional. A conditional covenant basically says that the covenant is only valid so long as the parties are faithful to their respective obligations, and then there's consequences if the covenant is violated. This is basic contract law. If they're faithful, then the blessings are received. If they break it, then the consequences of the curses are received and the covenant ends. The typical example of this is the suzerainty treaty, where the great king would enter into covenant with the lesser king or the vassal king. The agreement was usually that the vassal would give his daughters for marriage to the king and his men for war and pay some type of tribute or taxes. And the suzerain would offer protection and infrastructure and trade routes and ultimately that they wouldn't destroy him. That's one of the agreements. Hey, if you keep this, I won't destroy you. If the vassal didn't uphold their end, or they stopped sending men and ships and horses as tributes, and then the suzerain would threaten war. By the way, this is absolutely vital, and I honestly can't understress this. This is so vital to understanding the prophets or the prophetic literature in the Old Testament. When a vassal would violate a covenant, the suzerain wouldn't just mount up his armies and go siege the lesser king. It's expensive to do war back then. It was expensive. It was time consuming. You would go on these long, protracted campaigns. You had to keep everyone supplied, keep supply routes. You'd have to protect your land as you left, because effectively you're taking a huge portion of your army as you go. It was expensive to do war. And so what they would do, instead of just launching into war, they would send emissaries. Basically, they would send covenant administrators or prosecutors to go and declare violation and judgment. Condemnation and wrath are coming. Get in line. You're either going to lay down your shields or your dead bodies will be carried out on them. Right? Nearly all of the prophets, from Isaiah and Jeremiah to Obadiah and Zephaniah, were covenant prosecutors. They were emissaries from the great king Yahweh to the disobedient vassal kings of Judah and Israel, declaring to God's people that the covenant curses and blessings were on the line. You just cannot understand the prophets of the Old Testament if you don't understand the role that covenant and covenant keeping played in the ancient Near East. But in the Old Testament, we see more than these conditional suzerainty treaties between God and his people. Something strange happens. God's people are in violation of the covenant, and God declares to them to put down their shield or to come out on them. But he also says that after they've been carried out on their shields and the ravens will feast on their flesh, that Israel will live. God will spare a remnant for himself. He promises life to Israel even after they face total death. This reveals the undercurrent of an unconditional covenant that flows through the entire Bible. This is what Reformed Christians call the covenant of grace, that God has promised life to his people by his own name. He will make the covenant and ensure the conditions of its fulfillment, even if it means he has to bear the burden of the punishment itself. That's why there's this weird ceremony that happens in Genesis 15, 17, where God is entering into this covenant with Abraham, but he causes Abraham to kind of go into this deep sleep to avoid what was actually the covenant-keeping ceremony. So you'd go through this covenant-keeping ceremony. Effectively, what they would do is they would take an animal, they would rip it in two, and then they would both walk between it as kind of a symbol of saying, hey, if either of us break the covenant, let what has done to this animal be done to us. But what God does is God basically effectively takes Abraham, puts him out of commission, and God is the only one that walks through. He's saying, I am guaranteeing the fulfillment of this covenant. And if it doesn't happen, let what has done to this animal be done to me. Well, we know God is a covenant-keeping God. That's not going to happen. And so there's this unconditional element where God has promised that there will be this covenant that will be maintained. And so we have this example of an unconditional covenant, which is longstanding regardless of the faithfulness of the second party. Right, it's a unilateral promise of the initiating party to the reception party, of the greater king to the lesser king, of the suzerain to the vassal. This means that regardless of the faithfulness or faithlessness of the receptive party of Israel, the initiating party, the great king, would continue to ensure the blessing. Again, we'll see why this concept is so important, and we need to keep it in mind. Now, to tie all of these points together, we can begin by looking at a common formulation of Jesus, where he says, "You have heard X, but I tell you Y." Right? This is a prominent statement in his sermons and in his sayings. Jesus seems to be drawing on the fact that there are moral and ethical underpinnings, that there's a general equity of each law, and that our moral obligations are to those ethical underpinnings. Right? The surprising thing for the Christian is actually not that Jesus fulfilled the Old Testament law. I mean, that's surprising in itself, and that the civil law expired with Israel, but that the general equity of the laws are often harder to keep than the original law, even though they're less culturally derived. Right? We're not to only not murder, but we're not to hate. We're not only not to commit adultery, but we're not to lust. We're not only to remain pure, but we're to be as holy as God is holy. In some ways, the law is not of faith, but in other ways, it takes a tremendous amount of faith to keep. This is the law-gospel distinction. Now, we also see that the civil and ceremonial laws were given as a part of that conditional covenant, of the Mosaic covenant, specifically for the regulation of the theocratic state of the nation of Israel. When Israel failed to uphold its faithfulness to the covenant, they underwent the consequences stated at the end of the covenant, found primarily in the later chapters of Deuteronomy. However, we then find the promise of the hope of the new covenant beginning right there in Genesis 3, right at the moment of the fall, where God promises to protect a seed that will overcome. God then shed the blood of the animals to clothe and cover Adam and Eve, but they were exiled from the land to languish in sin and labor. But God promised he would shed the blood of his son, who would be the overcomer to clothe us and bring us back into Eden. Right, there's shedding of blood and clothing in each, except one led to exile, one led to return. This theme continues to develop and kind of snowball and get bigger as it follows redemptive history hurtling towards the cross. We see it continue to form in Jeremiah 31, which is an expression of the unconditional covenant meant to overcome the faithlessness of Israel. Yet in order to make this new covenant unconditional, God does away with the obligation of the civil and ceremonial obligations of geopolitical Israel by extending the blessings to all the people, all nations. No longer does a person have to become a national Jew in order to be a citizen of God's kingdom. And yet they still must become clean to enter. But the emphasis is on moral purity, on moral cleanliness, not on cultic purity or cultic cleanliness. God always called his people to moral purity, but the law now pedagogically points us to the cross and shows how unclean we really are. So since we cannot be clean on our own, since sin is the violation of the moral law, of which we're all guilty of, we must be redeemed by an act of grace in the shedding of blood. But it's not the blood of bulls and goats. This is what Jesus did. He was the culmination of the law, the perfect prophet speaking covenant blessings to his people on behalf of God, the perfect priest who does not need to atone for himself before he atones for others, the perfect king, absolutely holy, loving, and just to keep the law. He's unlike King David, who couldn't even keep the law for a moment. Jesus, on the other hand, keeps the law perfectly and keeps it for us as he rules his kingdom in righteousness over the nations. He's the one who wraps up all the loose ends and fulfills obligations, and yet takes the Mosaic curses due to us onto himself. But what does this mean for the non-Jew and the Jewish Christians? We see this this very discussion happening in Acts 15 with the so-called Jerusalem Council. We see in Acts 15 that the early church got together to discuss whether or not a Gentile must first become a Jew with regard to the law before they could become a Christian. That is, must they follow all the Old Testament law to become a Christian? This was the conclusion they came to. This is Acts 15, starting in verse 28. Quote, "It seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us not to burden you with anything beyond the following requirements. You are to abstain from food sacrificed to idols, from blood, from the meat of strangled animals, and from sexual immorality. You will do well to avoid these things." End quote. Notice that it was based on theological reasons of what the gospel is, not some desire to avoid the accusation of cherry-picking, that they came to the conclusion that Gentiles were not required to keep the law of geopolitical Israel. We even see this, Paul say this in Galatians 2. In 2:14 he writes, quote, "When I saw that they were not acting in line with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas in front of them all, 'You are a Jew, yet you live like a Gentile and not like a Jew. How is it then that you force the Gentiles to follow Jewish customs?'" End quote. Here, Paul condemns Peter, he calls him Cephas here, for forcing Gentiles to adhere to the Old Testament ceremonial laws. And he says that it's actually contrary to the gospel to force Christians to live by the Old Testament civil and ceremonial laws. And that's what Peter, or Cephas, at this point was doing when he was capitulating to the Judaizers. Right now, I know this has been somewhat long, but the point is that when an atheist wants to say that Christians are just cherry picking, when we don't live according to the specifics of the Old Testament law, all it does is show that they're just not familiar with biblical theology, any of this historical theology, New Testament theology, and the long history of covenantal and Christian interpretation of the scriptures. Now, I want to give one more caveat, that I'm not saying that one cannot read the Bible for themselves without decades of historical and textual studies, right? This has obviously taken a lot of study for me. I'm not saying that you can't understand the Bible without doing that. I'm simply saying that in order to understand what an ancient Near Eastern author means, it's often going to take some study precisely because it's so foreign to us. It doesn't mean you can't get the general principles, the general guidelines. It doesn't mean you can't follow it. But if you come up to an objection where something seems strange or odd and there's not a good answer, you know, prima facie on the face of it type of answer, don't be surprised if it takes a little bit of study. It's a foreign language. It's written to a foreign people in a foreign land 2,000 to 3,500 years ago. I like to give the example of Dante, specifically Dante's Inferno. Now, most of us have had to read Dante's Inferno at some point in our lives, in high school or college. And if you've had the distinct displeasure of trying to read Dante without the critical edition and all the footnotes on the history and symbolism of the book, it's almost impossible to appreciate the meaning of most of the text. Sure, you might be able to come up with the overall theme and narrative flow of the book and the basic plot line and characters, but almost every stanza is chock full of allusions and historically derived images and themes. So for example, in Canto 1, Dante writes, quote, "Of that sad Italy for which Nisus died, and Turnus and Euralius and the maid Camilla, he shall hunt her through every nation of sick pride," end quote. One would never be able to say that they've understood what that stanza meant if they don't do the study of the history of it. So why do we think that the Bible, which is written in a completely different time, on three different continents, in a different culture in every possible way, in three dead languages, from a different worldview, would not take study to understand what the author meant on some of these more nuanced and specific complex points, especially when we're talking about these challenging or opaque passages or the overall textual tapestry of the Bible, which is, again, an anthology of 66 different books by 40 different authors in three dead languages on three different continents across written across nearly 2,000 years. So again, all of this does not mean that one cannot read it on their own, but it does mean that in order to interpret it with any level of confidence, or when you're dealing with some of these more complex and nuanced issues and challenges, it might take some study into the backgrounds and contexts of the texts we're dealing with. So, all that being said, when the atheist accuses us of something as simplistic and ignorant as cherry-picking because they think we like shellfish and hate adultery, really, it just says more about their own intentions and ignorance than anything else. Well, thank you again for joining me on this episode of the Freethinker Podcast. As always, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, condemnations, or commendations, please feel free to reach out to me at freethinkerpodcast@gmail.com, visit the blog at freethinkerpodcast.blogspot.com, or come on by the group page on Facebook, the Freethinker Podcast group page. Join me again next time as we delve into some more hopefully interesting biblical and theological issues. Good night, and God bless.